You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you can be part of all of it.
Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. This is a first because I have Beth here with me today.
Hello.
And she's actually here with me. She's actually sitting next to me. This is the first time this has happened on History Hack.
The first of being able to do recordings together.
Yeah, we're sharing germs and everything.
Yeah.
Boom. This is amazing. Yeah. So what is also amazing, Beth, is it's World War One today, which is completely our wheelhouse.
Where we exactly want to be all the time.
Yeah, we don't want to leave.
No.
Tell us who's here with us.
Right, so we've got Andrea Hetherington with us today. So Andrea is an independent researcher and writer with a particular interest in social history surrounding the First World War. She's written a couple of books, a book on widows of the First World War, and this new one, her brand new book, is about deserters during the First World War.
Andrea, you picked some good subjects.
Yeah.
I picked some hard subjects. They're really hard to research, actually.
By good, I mean it's good that you do all the work and I can just read them.
But you're welcome.
Oh, easy, are they?
They're really tricky.
But you must have to really dig to make it into a kind of narrative.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but this is why I'm interested, because I think the best books come from not showing off what you know, but kind of displaying your journey almost. So I think the best books come from you answering a question like, I don't know anything about that. That's interesting. What's that all about then? And discovering that nobody's written about it. So you think, all right, well, I'll have to answer that question myself then. And before you know it, you're, 90,000 words in, you've got a book.
Every historian sitting there going, preach, because they know that they went to look for a book, it didn't exist, and they went on.
Yeah.
Myself. Right, okay. Should we start?
Yeah,
please.
Give us a definition of desertion, because I don't think people they're going to learn a lot today, I think, about what it actually means and punishments and things. When does a man stop being absent without leave and just naughty, like overstaying leave and stuff, and officially become guilty of the crime of desertion?
Well, the short answer is that he doesn't officially. I'll explain. Now, the definition of desertion comes from the Manual of Military Law, which is like the Bible for the British Army during the war. And it describes desertion as deserting or attempting to desert His Majesty's services, which is not the most helpful description I've ever seen, to be honest. But desertion is really to be understood by what it's not, which is absence without leave, which is quite tightly defined. So what they say about absence without leave is that that is such a short absence, unaccompanied by disguise, concealment, or other suspicious circumstances, as occurs when a soldier does not return to his corps or duty at the proper time, but on returning is able to show that he did not intend to quit the service or to evade the performance of some service so important as to render the offence desertion. So, in short, it's all about the intention of the soldier.
Right.
So things like how long you'd been gone, how far you'd gone, whether you were still in uniform, what had happened while you'd been gone, all went to a decision kind of after the fact as to whether you were guilty of desertion or absence. So the manual uses an example of a man found in plain clothes on a ship going to America as one where desertion would fairly clearly...
You've got no intention of coming back, have you?
Exactly, yeah. But you could also not even leave camp, but still be guilty of desertion if you were intending to avoid a particular duty. So, for example, and there's lots of examples of this, if your unit was off to France in the hour and you just went and hid in a cupboard somewhere until they'd all gone, then that was desertion, not absence, even though you might have only been gone an hour.
Yeah.
So the distinction between the two was a really fine one, and it wasn't applied consistently. And like I say, it was applied kind of after the fact. I mean, you were officially declared a deserter after you'd been missing for 21 days. But as I say, that's not determinative, because you could be gone an hour and still be guilty of desertion. So this distinction is really loose, because the benefit of the doubt was supposed to be given to the soldier, meaning that you were supposed to be charged with absence without leave, not desertion, if there was any room to do so. And room was very often found. So offences that on the face of it looked very much like desertion were downgraded to absence instead, partly so they could be dealt with more quickly and without necessarily going through the whole court-martial procedure.
I think, yeah, that when we did the Chelsea book, which is a Leeds fan, I know you'll be dying to talk about, we looked at, because they did their initial training at White City, they let them go on the weekends, and they're all buggers for coming back, overstaying leave and overstaying weekend off, because they're just like, they stroll back in a day late, drunk, and go, oops. We had one guy, and we still maintain it's the best disciplinary record I've ever seen, because everything happened over one night, and he had back chatting an officer, leaving White City without permission, drunkenness, urinating on the wheel of a lorry, back chatting the sergeant that caught him, and then trying to punch him in the face. He obviously went on a bender and had the best night out ever and came back. It's actually quite, it's fuzzy, isn't it? And I think a lot of the time, I mean, we always hear the story, don't you, about the sleeping sentry and the officer just kicked him awake. I mean, that's a death sentence, but obviously in common sense land, in theatre, it's a, it's a wholly different concept, isn't it?
It is. And as I say, you know, there are offences and you think, oh, that's desertion, that, and then you if you're lucky enough to be able to follow it through, you find that they actually just got 28 days confined to barracks or something, and it was downgraded to being absent without leave. And on the face of things like, you know, how long they've been gone, etc., you think, well, I can't see any justification for that. But of course they can't be heavy-handed with everybody, because they need to get people back into the ranks. You know, both on the home front and abroad. You know, they can't have people languishing in jail for years, although some people did, because they need to recycle the manpower. So a lot of the punishments were really light.
Actually, how prevalent was it in the British Army during the First World War? Is it something that you find does happen a lot, or is it actually quite rare?
No, it happens a lot. I think it's much more common than people have generally thought. I mean, the real figures will unfortunately never be known, so reasons I'll explain in a bit. But if we just look at the numbers for men that were actually court-martialed, so taken to a military court for the offences of desertion and absence without leave on the home front, which is what I'm mostly concerned with. Yeah. So court-martials on the home front for those offences, 82,423. Court-martials on all fronts for desertion and absence is nearly 127,000. And the number of men struck off the strength, which is where they're missing for 21 days, so they're declared deserters, during the war, it's 147,000. So, and the net loss to the British Army for desertion during the war, so that's the number of deserters minus the number that returned from desertion during the war as a whole, is 82,000. So had you lost 82,000 men in a particular battle, it would take its place in the ranks of disasters like the Somme and Passchendaele, wouldn't it? So to lose that number of men and never came back is quite significant. But as I say, the numbers who actually engaged in desertion would be even bigger than that. The reasons being that those figures that I've just given you are just for court martials. So those are just for men who were put before the court on their rearrest. So what those statistics don't reflect is that there were loads of soldiers who made off, were recaptured, and were not court-martialed, because it wasn't obligatory. Your commanding officer could punish you without reference to a court-martial, especially if he downgraded your offence to being absent without leave. So large numbers were merely punished by their commanding officer in a lesser fashion, and are therefore not showing up in those figures. And also, the numbers struck off the strength won't be as high as those who ran off for shorter periods. So if you have to be missing for 21 days to be struck off the strength, if you were gone but you'd managed to come back before the 21 days were up, you wouldn't be in those figures either. So I think hundreds of thousands of men will have an entry on their record for absence or desertion. And I think it was an everyday part of military life, and it was far more widespread than might be imagined at this juncture. And I think it's also was culturally accepted to a degree. Taking some extra time off certainly for a citizen soldier, wasn't seen as a heinous crime. And the proliferation of slang around this practice, I think, is illustrative of this. So you'll have heard of French leave, doing a guy, swinging the lead. There's loads of other terms that soldiers had for not being where you're supposed to be at the right time. So I think it really was part of the strategy for the citizen soldier for navigating their way through the war. So I think if you seek an answer to the question, what did your ancestor do in the Great War? The answer might surprise you.
Yeah, this is so my thesis at the moment is self-inflicted wounds. And it's the same. How many? You will never know. You will never know because of the ones where people just let it go, or people didn't get found out, or it wasn't reported, or they just went into a casualty clearing station and nobody wrote it down. And so it's one of those difficult things to try and recreate, because it wasn't written about at the time. I think the first connection people make with desertions in their heads is the sad cases. You desert, they shoot you. Why is this a dangerous assumption to make?
Well, a concentration on those shot at dawn deserters is massively disproportionate, and it obscures the experience of the vast majority of men who committed the offence of desertion and did so either temporarily or permanently, just because the army didn't suit them at the time. So there's only 266 soldiers shot for desertion itself. If you compare those to the figures I've just given you, just for those deserters that were court-martialed, you'll see there's a huge disparity there. I think it also leads people to believe that everyone who deserted was shot, and that all those who deserted were later pardoned 100 years later because they were all suffering from shell shock. And none of this is necessarily true. So the shot at dawn cases are not representative of deserters in general, and they don't show the level of non-cooperation with the war effort that was present, which I think has been very much obscured, even over the centenary period. There's this belief that we're all in it together and everybody was doing their bit, apart from these poor deserters who were suffering from shell shock and were all shot. And it's not really the true picture.
So what are the usual punishments for desertion, Andrea? What kind of, could you put it in the context of the circumstances, you know, for those deserters? Would they have, you know, pay docked, or would there be more severe punishments for them?
Okay. Well, theoretically, whilst the country's at war, the death penalty exists for deserters, whether they've walked away from a trench in France or from a parade ground in Aldershot, because the designation of being on active service applies to both situations. But in practice, the death penalty is not imposed for desertions at home. But there are 14 cases of the shot at dawn deserters where the soldier was actually arrested in Britain, but taken back to the front for his court-martial and eventually executed. And those were men who'd overstayed their leave, or two cases where they had hidden to avoid a draft that was going to the front. And one poor man who was arrested in France, but was transported back to Britain so that he could be identified, and then was taken back to France and shot. So it didn't apply the death penalty for desertion on the home front, but it did in certain circumstances. But generally, if you go before a court-martial as a soldier on the home front, it would be a district court-martial where their maximum punishment was 2 years imprisonment. Very aggravated offences, and all offences for officers would go before a general court-martial where the punishments were harsher and could include the death penalty, though, as I say, that never happened. But there were only a tiny, tiny proportion of general court-martials on the home front, around 3,000, where there were 130,000-odd district court-martials. So tiny proportion. So the vast majority of men who were sentenced by court-martial on the home front got sentences of military detention, and there were just over 100,000 such sentences handed down. But those sentences were then reviewed by senior officers and were often reduced or remitted to return men to service more quickly. Short sentences of detention, so less than 7 days, would be served in cells at the barracks, while soldiers serving longer periods were shipped out to military detention facilities around the country. But you're right about the docking of pay. Both deserters and absentees had their pay docked for every day they were missing and every day they were serving any kind of punishment. They're also liable to pay for every piece of their issued kit that was missing when they came back, and for the cost of an escort to go and collect them. Now, absentees, as I've said earlier, were much less likely to have to face court-martial proceedings in the first place, as the summary powers of punishment available to the company commander and to their commanding officer allowed for a range of punishments to be imposed that stopped short of imprisonment. So an absentee could get up to 28 days detention under these summary powers without going anywhere near a court martial. Other punishments available being field punishment number one, which you've heard being tied to an object either outside for a few hours, though there's a debate as to whether that ever happened on the home front, or number two, which was basically just being kept within the barracks, within a room at the barracks, or just confinement to barracks, which is known as CB or jankers, sometimes extra duties, and of course the forfeiture of pay. So the range of punishments was really quite wide. And again, this distinction over absence without leave or desertion would play into that as well. But there was also just a really kind of arbitrary element to military justice, which I think was part of its power, really. You never really knew what was going to happen to you.
Yeah, absolutely. It just depends who you get on what given day, doesn't it? How many? Yeah. I'm interested to know how many serial deserters you find. So if a man does it once, how likely is he to do it again? Because I've seen a couple of service files. I was looking at one this morning, actually. The guy's a nightmare. If you let him out of sight for long enough, he's off.
Yeah, well, there's lots of men like that. But there's no hard and fast rule. For some men, one brush with the authorities was enough, and their record after's exemplary. I've found a few examples, a lot of examples of men who will just get themselves into trouble once. Some of them go on to win medals. One of them that I found and researched, he was in big trouble at the start of his military career, but he went on to win a medal and lose a leg in an action. So some men, it's just a blip. It's either a misunderstanding of the rules, or it's because they've had something they've had to deal with briefly, gone and dealt with it and come back. But some of them would desert time after time, as you say. Interestingly, 91 of the shot at dawn cases were already under suspended sentences for desertion at the time that they committed their last offence. So some men deserted time after time because they were just not used to military life, didn't like it. But some deserted because they were making a living from selling their army kit. So there's a number of examples of this serial desertion, and people often worked in gangs, enlisting and deserting en masse. So I found an example in Belfast in February 1915, where four deserters with 10 different aliases between them appeared in court for this particular offence. So they'd joined quite a few regiments since war was declared, and they were finally arrested because they'd enlisted in the Royal Irish Rifles the day after enlisting and deserting from the Leinsters. And suspicion was aroused by the fact that as soon as they got their Royal Irish Rifles uniforms, they were selling the kit they'd already been given from the other regiment. Mm. Some joined regiments, found it didn't suit them and left, but then joined another regiment immediately, hoping for a better experience. And this was a phenomenon called fraudulent enlistment, which needs to be put alongside desertion and absence without leave, because it was also rife in the First World War.
Joined an infantry unit and was like, no, I don't fancy this, and just went and served in the artillery instead.
Yeah, exactly. I've got an example of a guy who joined an ordinary regiment, and in his billets with this regiment, he saw a photograph of the woman's husband in a Grenadier Guards uniform and thought, oh, hang on, I like that uniform. So deserted and went off and joined them instead. So it was something that was quite rife. And as I say, it's only something that's recently been uncovered. I mean, you'll not infrequently find soldiers' records of various kinds with "also known as" stamped on them, or "served as" wherever you look, whether that's on their medal cards, on their service records, the Commonwealth War Graves records of burials. You'll find quite a range of those, and I think that's something that's only recently kind of coming to light, really. And I have found examples of men deserting a range of regiments. One guy called Henry Tuft managed to join and desert three different regiments between August and October 1914. Another guy appeared in court as a deserter and was telling the magistrates that, he'd served about four or five different regiments that he'd served in. And then the prosecutor kind of burst his bubble by telling the court that, yes, he had served in those regiments, but unfortunately he deserted from all of them. So there were a lot of these guys. Some of them will not have been detected because they've joined up in another name, in another regiment, and they've just cracked on with it. And some were. There's a lot of people that just kind of moved around.
It might have been pre-digital age, pre-photo ID.
Yes, exactly. That's the next point. If somebody says that they are someone, how are you going to disprove that? You know, there's no joined up thinking between, not even between regiments, never mind between branches of the service. He'd have people deserting the army to join the Navy and vice versa. How are you going to prove that this isn't the person? No one was expected to have their birth certificate with them. This is the reason why so many underage soldiers joined up and were able to join up, isn't it? Because you could, if somebody, obviously there's a lot of collusion from the recruiting sergeants, but generally if somebody turned up and said, I'm 19, I want to join the army, they wouldn't have any proof of that, but equally you wouldn't have any proof that they were not. So,
yeah, I think as well, like you say, there's a motivation for them to get as many enlisted as possible. So, impressed with drilling to the bottom of who someone says they are you? If they give you,
you haven't got time. You know, you just need to get these people in, and you just haven't got time to do it. So, you know, there were some telltale signs sometimes when you were trying to enlist another regiment. I found an example of a couple of guys who did it, and whilst they were having their medical, they took their jackets off, and the recruiters immediately saw that they were already wearing Kitchener issue shirts, so they were obviously soldiers from somewhere else. Vaccination marks would be another telltale sign, often, as people are often not vaccinated until they joined the army. So that was another sign when people were trying to see if somebody might be a deserter or wanted elsewhere. If they were vaccinated, there was a good chance they'd been in the army at some stage.
I think let's talk about some specific cases. This one isn't on the list, but I didn't know this till just now. Today's the anniversary of someone in Beth's family.
Yeah, he's in my family by marriage.
Okay. Yeah.
His mom married into my family generations back, and he enlisted. He was in the 1st 6th Battalion of the King's Liverpool Regiment, was at 3rd Ypres, and killed on the 31st of July 1917. He went AWOL at the beginning of July, and was missing for about 10 days. Mm. But I think because he was an absentee, like you said, Andrea, it didn't go to a court-martial, but I have found documentation where he was actually docked his pay when he was then presented to his, as you say, something like his company commander. And then his punishment was 2 weeks of docked pay, and he was actually on docked pay when he was killed. Meningate.
Yeah. Yeah, so as I say, yeah, he's the kind of man you're not going to see in the statistics for desertion or absence without leave, because he never had to go to a court martial. So now there must be hundreds of thousands of guys that have done something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
They've got that on their service record. But as you know, not all the service records survive, and it would just be a case of you know, doing some mad trawl through them. Yeah.
You'd have to be insane.
Yeah, it's just beyond, to be honest, to be able to sit down and do that. Though, you know, when you do have a random look, sometimes you look at something for other reasons, and you will find that on the record, and then, you know, I try and see if it's a story worth using. But yeah, it's not an untypical story, that, no.
I mean, when we researched the Chelsea book, we did a cross section, and brilliantly, we found something like 85 to 90% of the 17th Middlesex service files from the first 1,500 guys. So the guys that enlisted on the base, join and play with them, they survive. And actually, we went through every single one of them because we were trying to pinpoint who the Chelsea fans were. And more.
But they're not all shot.
More men had disciplinary infractions than didn't. I mean, the idea that anyone went through their military service without once getting into trouble, especially this lot based at White City with London on their doorstep,
that's a big draw.
One case was Bob Whiting, and this is quite a famous one. Mm. So he played for Chelsea, but he was Brighton's keeper at the time, and he joins the Footballers' Battalion, and he goes missing for quite some time during the Battle of the Somme. Basically, his wife is pregnant with their third child, and he just doesn't go back after leave, and he's run down, he's arrested, they put him through disciplinary and everything, and yet they put him straight back into his battalion, and he's killed at Arras. How typical is his case?
Bob Whiting, he didn't return from leave, did he? He was sent home suffering from scabies, I think, wasn't he? And he wasn't missing that long. He was missing from June till October 1916, arrested at home, sent back across the Channel. And as you say, he got his initial sentence was he got 9 months hard labour, but he was pretty immediately recycled back into the ranks because that sentence, all the sentences went up the chain for what we call promulgation, yeah, which is like checking. And his sentence was then suspended. So his case was quite typical in a number of ways. So the suspension of the sentence was entirely typical. This was introduced in May 1915 because, as I indicated earlier, there were too many men languishing in detention when manpower was essential. So sentences after May 1915 were routinely suspended to allow a man to prove himself again. So be hanging over them would be reviewed in a certain number of months and could either then be imposed if they hadn't behaved themselves or resuspended or remitted. So that suspension of sentence for him was entirely typical. So some took the hint, like Bob, and didn't get into any further trouble, and some didn't. So a significant proportion, as I say, of those shot at Dawn were actually under suspended sentences, some of them suspended death sentences. He was also typical in that failing to return from leave was a problem. He was lucky he wasn't shot, actually, as some men in his position were. For example, Peter Sands, an Irish soldier, he was shot for overstaying his leave. He went home on leave to Belfast. He didn't go back at the time he was supposed to. Stayed an extra couple of months, was arrested in Belfast, taken back across to France, court-martialed, death sentence imposed and carried out. But as I said earlier,
about Whiting, can I ask, do you think his celebrity played into his commuted sentence, or is it like you're saying?
No. I really don't. The instructions were given after May 1915 that you were not to impose immediate imprisonment unless it was absolutely necessary. So the default position was always going to be that you suspended that sentence. So no, I very much doubt that his celebrity will have played into that at all, actually. But failure to return to leave, like I said, was a problem. But it sounds to him like, obviously, his wife was pregnant, about to give birth to a third child. So here's an example of family problems causing people to desert, family issues. And that was very frequent as well. Illnesses of family members, children especially, that was a frequent reason for men to decide that they needed to go home for a bit. Wives potentially not behaving themselves, that was another reason. A number of men cited the fact that they'd heard their wives were having affairs for reasons why they'd not come back on time or they'd gone home. So yeah, his family situation, that's an entirely typical reason for him to desert. And another typical aspect of his case is when you actually look at his service record, the offence of desertion was downgraded to being absent without leave.
Yeah, he's back in time for November on the Somme, isn't he? And he's, as I said, at Arras in April. So actually it's like a 3-month spell away from an otherwise standard participation in all the offensives that are going on.
Some of the men that you've researched, Andrea, take the offence of desertion and really, they don't just desert, do they? They embellish and they go and do things like impersonate potentially other troops that have been killed. So could you tell us something a bit about those and why they do what they do and how they do it?
Okay. Well, it all comes down to survival, really, on the home front and the strategies deserters use to support themselves, because, of course, they're not getting their army pay now, are they? Because they're gone.
Yeah,
so their pay is stopped immediately. So they need to find other ways of making a living, etc. So lots of men would just go home and lie low, get rid of their uniforms, have nothing to connect them to the army, spend their days in the attic or the coal cellar, whilst others actually hid in plain sight, cavorting around and presenting themselves as war heroes when they were actually on the run. So impersonation's got a number of different levels. And some of the most audacious frauds are committed by deserters who pretend to be officers, taking advantage of that class bias that meant that an officer's word was worth more than that of the average Tommy. For example, Laurie Bell, aka Lorenzo Reginald Bell, he pretended to be an officer and he committed frauds in various locations, the cheekiest being that he forged an order from the War Office to allow him to go to the Tower of London and select himself a revolver, no less, that no doubt he was sold. At one stage, he was even working as a recruiting sergeant in Bradford whilst he was actually a deserter. It's quite astonishing. But so there's a lot of impersonation of officers going on, because people would accept checks from officers by the time that's bounced, because it's not your account. You're on the way to somewhere else. You're staying in some other hotel somewhere else in the country, living it up and writing more bad checks. So that was really prevalent. But some impersonations, as you've indicated, were more small scale and more heartbreaking, as deserters presented themselves to families as their missing relatives. There was a number of levels of this that fell short of that. For example, a lot of people would just scan the local papers for who was missing or who'd been killed, and go to those families and pretend to have served with the man and pretend to be there with a message from him or something like that, just to get some money, maybe it's some free accommodation for a couple of days, even just a meal, something like that. There's a lot of that went on. But I have found two cases of these Martin Guerre scenarios, if I put it that way, that are quite astonishing. In one case, a man called George Hall walked into a shop run by a Mrs. Tandy and declared himself to be her missing husband. Now, he did bear a resemblance to her husband, who had actually been killed at Gallipoli, though she was unaware of that fact at the time. And George Hall ended up being convicted of rape once his identity was uncovered, because had his true identity been known, no such intimacy would have taken place. But she, for a period of time, had convinced herself that he was her husband. In another, a man called Thomas Baker convinced a whole family, including his fiancée, that he was the missing man. And they held to that belief even after the police got involved. The family was split on two sides as to who thought he was the real person and who thought he wasn't. And it was only when his real mother was brought to court, when he was arrested and charged, that he finally accepted that he wasn't this man. Now, interestingly, I have seen photographs of this guy and the man he was impersonating, and he looked nothing like the missing man, who was actually incarcerated in a POW camp at the time, but in a far less tragic outcome, did eventually come home and marry his fiancée. Now, whether the real man ever learnt the story of the fake man, I really don't know. I did actually make contact on this one with a family member who knew about her relative's war service, but was completely shocked when I shared this impersonation story with him, because nobody in the family had ever mentioned it. I suspect his fiancée, later his wife, was probably very embarrassed about the whole thing and just wanted to completely sweep it under the carpet. So, as I say, the existing members of the family certainly didn't know about it until I told them.
I love that he finally, they wheeled his mum out in court and he went on.
Yeah.
I admit.
They did that a few times, actually.
Angry mum staring you down and going, all right.
Yeah. Well, in the other case, they wheeled his wife in, who I think was more interested in having a go at this other woman, saying, if my husband walked in, I would surely know who he was or who he wasn't. Wheeling family members in, that was not infrequent, where people were insistent that they were this person. They weren't a deserter. They were this person. It was not infrequent, actually. One of the, what I'll call the home runner shot at dawn cases, the guy that was arrested in France but brought back to England to be identified. He was identified in court by his own sister, who said, oh, no, that's my brother. I think if she'd realised that they were then going to shoot him, she might have kept her mouth shut.
How hard did the authorities look for these men? I'm particularly interested in how much capability they've got to, because there's a war on and surely this is just a pain in the arse. So does it vary? I'm guessing that some guys get run down really hard and others, I mean, you've got a case of two brothers that's really surprising, haven't you?
Well, I think throughout the war there's an issue with capacity, but I think certainly at the start of the war the army haven't got the capacity to conduct thorough searches for these men. The military police are very, very small in number at the start of the war, 401 military policemen in the whole of Great Britain, which is a tiny, tiny number. So they didn't have the ability really to do it. So the job was left mostly to the civilian police, certainly in the early stages of the war. By the end of the war, the number of military police on the home front increases tenfold, but still it's mostly the job of the civilian police. So when a man's declared a deserter, his details are passed to the Police Gazette for publication, and they would print his name, his regimental number, his corps, details of his appearance, like his height, any distinguishing marks, his pre-army trade, the location where he enlisted, and his place of birth. So that was distributed, obviously, throughout the country to the police, and police constables were meant to be on the alert for them. especially in the area where they might have previously lived. So it's like the police national computer of its day. Mm. Now, from the start of the war, they're carrying an average of 1,000 names a week for men who are wanted for absence and desertion. Again, that's a significant number if you look at the difference between that and the men who were court-martialed. Significantly more of them are being put in the police gazette than ever eventually faced a court-martial. Now, the police top brass were getting pretty fed up with this because they were getting so many inquiries from the army about missing men. And the Met complained about it. Manchester police complained about it. But the copper on the street loved nicking deserters because when you took them to court, you got a reward. So the court would give you a reward of between 5 and 20 shillings, which would boost your income considerably. Usual reward was about 10 shillings. It was supposed to vary on the amount of initiative and trouble taken by the officer to arrest this person, but they would get a reward. So I think the police on the street were probably quite keen on nicking deserters. But as I say, the top brass were not, because obviously they had so many other things to do during the war that this was just one extra thing that was just really a pain for them. But the Ship Brothers case, that is a really interesting story. So on Boxing Day 1914, so this is the day after the Christmas truce, they weren't involved in it, but their unit were, and they were supposed to be relieving their unit that night in the trenches. But they were in billets in a French village. So they're with the 13th London Battalion, also known as the Kensingtons.
Yeah.
So they get up in the morning in this French village and they go off to buy bread, so everybody thinks, and they never come back. Now, some of their colleagues thought they might have drowned because the path they took went alongside this fast-flowing river, but no bodies ever appeared. So nobody really seems very interested in the case until October 1916. So, you know, nearly 2 years later, when suddenly the War Office start asking what's happened to these two. Again, nothing happens. The trail's cold until February 1917, when a man's arrested for desertion in a hostel off the Edgware Road in London. He insists his name's Jack Smith and he's a deserter from the Royal Fusiliers. Further investigation follows. This is another case where family members are brought in to identify him. In this case, it was his parents. And they discover this is actually Charles Shipp, one of these men that's been missing since Boxing Day 1914.
Wow.
So he's court-martialed. He's taken back across Channel. He's court-martialed, unsurprisingly, convicted of desertion. And he's actually sentenced to death. But on review, that becomes 5 years imprisonment, and then that's suspended. And he won't tell them how he manages to get across the Channel or what he's been doing for 2 years. But he does tell them that his brother was killed shortly after they ran off. But this isn't true, because one Harry Shipp came home and enlisted in the Essex Regiment, where he spent the rest of the war on the home front. Now, interestingly, as I said, nobody was interested in this case until October 1916. Well, that coincides with one Harry Shipp being court-martialed for a different offence, for chatting back to an officer, basically, not for desertion. But it's an interesting connection there in the dates. Because after that, I suspect it's his court-martial that triggers that further investigation into what happened. So did Harry do a deal and grass his brother up? I think we'll never know at this stage, but it's a really interesting one. Now, also interestingly, both of them are very keen to boast about their military service after the war. Charles applies for the requisite extra bit on his medal because he was under fire in 1914, so he needs a clasp. Whereas Harry posts an entirely fanciful entry in the National Roll of the Great War, which lies about all of his activities. Obviously doesn't mention his desertion, but lists all these battles he was involved in, which he clearly was not, because he was back home by then. Now, interestingly, my friend Tom Thorpe's done a lot of work on the Kensington's battalion. And when he got my book and he saw the story, he was astonished, because he'd heard the very start of this story from there's an account from one of the guys that served with them of the day they went missing, but he dismissed it as being too far-fetched to be true, but it actually is true. So that's really interesting.
I love that. I think that's some really insane story of the pair of them as well. It is a bit sus, isn't it?
Like, Becca twitches every time she hears the Kensingtons because of Goncourt in 1916. No. Do you know what? Actually, I'm doing my data set for the self-inflicted wounds as well, and the amount of them, the poor London Division, 56th Division at Ginchy. My God.
Just gets even worse.
The desperation with some of the descriptions of what they're doing to get out of service.
Well, I've not done much on self-inflicted wounds, but I mean, I know they were, if they were deemed to have self-inflicted, they would send, they couldn't even go to a normal hospital, could they? They went to a special hospital.
So they didn't,
for naughty people.
Everybody else, yeah. We're complete nerds, Beth and I, aren't we?
We absolutely are. Yeah, and being nerds, that means we love a good source, whether it be primary or secondary. So what kind of sources did you use to find out all of this interesting information, and how did you actually get onto this subject itself?
Well, I think that the how is probably the first thing to start with. So in the introduction, you mentioned my last book was on Britain's First World War widows, still available from all the usual stockists.
I'll put it on the History Hack bookshop as well, just so people
Thank
can get
you.
Even easier. It's great. It's the
penny royalties.
Yeah, the Forgotten Legion, you called it, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Yeah. I called it that because I do think it's a forgotten story, but the British War Widows Association wasn't founded until 1971. And at the cenotaph ceremony each year, for a lot of years, they were refused the ability to participate. And what they would do would be, they would have their own little ceremony the night before, and they would lay a wreath or a cross of white chrysanthemums, which was their emblem. And the card that they left with that would say, you know, from Britain's War Widows, the Forgotten Legion. So that's where I got the title for the book from. But anyway, so during the research for that book, I came across some poor widows who were duped into marrying men who only wanted them for their pensions. Once you remarried as a war widow, your pension stopped, but you got a big lump sum of either a year or 2 years pension, depending on the stage of the war we're talking about. So that's quite a significant lump of money. So they'd get married, they would get that quite quickly, actually. They would then get this big lump sum. These guys would work their way through it, and then they'd disappear. Awesome. So when I looked into those, to my surprise, a lot of those men turned out to be deserters. So obviously, as I said earlier, their army pay was cut off as soon as they deserted, and they obviously saw these women as an easy mark, basically. So that kind of piqued my interest, and I thought, okay, so hang on, how many of these home front deserters were there, and how did they manage to survive in what was virtually a military state when they were on the run from the military? I then discovered that there was no answer to that because nobody had ever researched or written about it. So I thought, okay, well, I better do it myself then. Yeah. So I started to look into it, and I was really astonished by you know, what I found, both in terms of the numbers, as we've discovered, but also the individual stories, which, you know, are quite amazing, really. So in terms of sources, well, I don't make life easy for myself. The reason people don't write about these topics, widows, deserters, is because they're hard to research. I think you really need some tenacity and the ability to do quite a lot of lateral thinking about sources and where you might get stuff from. So my sources are a mixture of the official records and more informal sources like memoirs and newspapers. So for government records, of course, you go to the National Archives, where you'll find some records. For example, the Shot at Dawn files, as you'll be aware, have been saved in their entirety. Unfortunately, nobody else's stuff has, but the Shot at Dawn files have. Cabinet discussions, War Office reports, where you find the true picture of people that are not turning up under conscription, et cetera, et cetera. I looked at a lot of publications of the war years. I went, sat in the British Library, reading every single issue of Justice of the Peace magazine, for example, which is not riveting, let me tell you. Every issue of John Bull, which was more interesting. And then, of course, there's the British Newspaper Archive, which is a really rich resource for social historians. But you've got to be prepared to do the digging when you find something there and not just take it at face value and try and cross-reference sources. So you make sure that you really do dig into a story and get the most out of it. And sometimes just a random trawl of men's service records does throw up stories that you might never have found elsewhere. And I have found some stuff when I've been researching something entirely different. I was researching for a television company who made the, I think it was called 100 Days to Victory programme that was on the BBC, 18 months ago now, 2 years ago. And I wasn't researching deserters at all. They sent me to look at some files that they hoped would be of men that were involved in those battles, and most of them weren't. But one of them I found was actually a deserter, and he had left some tantalising glimpses of this within the file that was in the archives, in that he was trying to, he deserted, it's very towards the end of the war, he was a regular soldier and he deserted. I don't think he felt he was capable of going back. And he wanted to sort it all out after the war, surrender himself. So there were some letters that he'd written and replies that he'd got back from various people, MPs, etc., that he'd tried to get some advice from. So as you'll know from when you're doing research, sometimes you're researching something completely different, but you'll find this little gem that leads you on a different track, a completely different rabbit hole.
Yeah, rabbit holing is probably the most fun thing about being...
It is, yeah. But you waste days, don't you? You'll think, I wonder if I'll just have a look at that. And before you know it, you've spent the whole day doing it and you might not have got anything.
Created a new spreadsheet for something else.
Yeah, my rabbit holing, I have a spreadsheet of 22,000 Frenchmen who died on one day in 1914. And this week's rabbit hole was social Darwinism boom. Ooh. In Germany.
Ooh.
In the years. Ooh. Of the First World War.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow.
They're all losers. Yeah, but we love basically. It. We can't get enough of it. Andrea, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about your new book.
No.
And everybody else, what it's called again?
It's called Deserters of the First World War, The Home Front. And it's available from all good stockists.
Namely the History Hack Bookshop as well, which means not only does Andrea get money, we get money as well.
Oh, well, that's a win-win then.
Yeah, probably the publisher as well, but we don't care so much about that.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.